Before I begin, I first want to thank Bill Campbell and the Philadelphia Society for asking me to speak at this general meeting. Since I first started coming to Philadelphia Society meetings as a guest and then later as a member, it's been a great pleasure to watch and meet so many people important to my intellectual development at these meetings. And it's a great privilege to actually be up at the podium and contributing to that tradition of conversation. I'd also like to thank Lee for those kind words about my book. I don't know if it's essential reading for anybody but Mom, but I appreciate the nice things he had to say about it. Our topic this morning is challenges of conservatism to the younger generation, and I'm somewhat flattered to be included in that younger generation. As my kids remind me regularly, I'm inconceivably old. But this morning I'd like to go even further back in history than my own development to a book Russell Kirk wrote in the early 50s, first called A Program for Conservatives and then republished in the 80s as Prospects for Conservatives. And if you know the book, you know that he organizes his subject into a series of questions, question of wants, question of tradition, question of power. And it sort of is the closest thing that Kirk came to writing a political program book, although there isn't a policy recommendation in it, as is typical. But I'd like to update some of those questions that he posed into challenges. Because I think that even though Kirk passed away in 94, 13 years ago this weekend, before September 11th and before the Bush administration, I think he still has a lot to say to us. Kirk, in his book, has a chapter called The Question of Tradition. And I think now, for conservatives of my age, that really is a challenge, because we don't really know what tradition is or where how to get it or where it is going. But I'd like to take a step back from that initially and say, to remind us that, as Stan Evans said yesterday when he spoke about life cycles, that conservatism's great adversary since the 40s and the 50s, aside from communism, its domestic adversary, liberalism, also has a life cycle. And I'd argue that that life cycle indicates now that as a comprehensive tradition of intellectual history and of thought is largely dead. What has happened to it, having been transmogrified really beyond recognition in the 60s and 70s by the Cultural Revolution, and combined with a corrosive popular culture, which while derived from, I think is independent from liberalism, and which is opposed even by many contemporary liberals themselves, has largely rendered itself incapable of sustaining a political culture. And where Kirk comes in here is, while he is most often thought of as the great antagonist of liberalism of the 50s and 60s, and indeed his great book, The Conservative Mind, was intended as a contrast to that liberal tradition of thought, which was so strong that people like Lionel Trilling thought there was no other, he was actually doing something different. What his admirers sometimes miss is that even in the 50s, he was looking to the end of liberalism. He had already thought it was dying. Kirk, early on, thought that the bases that inform liberalism, its emphasis on individualism, the utilitarianism of the mills, socialism, all were insufficient bases. And in 1955, in a piece called The Dissolution of Liberalism, was already writing its obituary. He writes, "The liberal system attained popularity because it promised progress without the onerous duties exacted by tradition and religion. It is now in the process of dissolution because, founded upon an imperfect and distorted myth, it has been unable to fulfill its promise, and because it no longer appeals in any degree to the higher imagination. It has been undone by social dissolution." And aside from some totalitarian revolution, which Kirk thought unlikely in the United States, he suggested that a Machiavellian scheme founded upon self-interest and creature comforts would take hold in American culture. I don't think there is a better description of our popular culture of at least the last 20 years than that, combined with a somewhat vulgar youth culture, combined with the materialism of the boomers. But it wasn't liberalism. And so I think it is a mistake for conservatives to focus on attacking solely liberalism, because I think we have moved into what has passed from an ideological conflict to a civilizational one. And I think that what was called, I think on Friday night, the culturization of popular conservatism is a mistake. It is addressing the wrong enemy. What Kirk saw from liberalism's ending was something he called the age of sentiments, whose central feature was television and the false images it projects, and one can imagine now with the internet projected even further. He describes the immense majority of human beings will feel with the projected images they behold upon the television screen. And in those viewers, the screen will rouse sentiments rather than reflections. Waves of emotion will sweep back and forth so long as the age of sentiments endures. And Kirk thought where the challenge of conservatives of his generation and of ours is to address people at that level of sentiments. And how did he think that this could be done? Well, he did this, as those of you who knew him know, not only through his work, but in his life. He told ghost stories, revived children's games, created a stable home for refugees from modernity's whirl, and lived in explicit countercultural or countertradition, a counterexample to the liberal tradition. So I think that his example in how to navigate this post-liberal, or what I call in my book, the post-modern age, is the first challenge of people of my age and younger. The second question that I want to turn to a challenge Kirk has in his book called The Question of Power. And we've heard a lot this weekend about the role of principle in practical politics, of fusionism, of the possibility of winning and retaining electoral power. I think Kirk reminds us that the challenge here is not to be too obsessed with power, both achieving it and maintaining it, and also to always remain suspicious of it. And I think that the words spoken earlier today about the need for decentralization and federalism are quite apt. Conservatives get into trouble when they take political power without knowing what it's for, as Stan Evans reminded us yesterday. And in Prospects for Conservatives, Kirk addresses this at a couple of different levels, both nationally and internationally. Nationally, he found the constitutional scheme of ordered liberty and federalism the most conducive to protecting freedom, calling it the chief attainment of American political philosophy. He, of course, was neither an anarchist without any law, nor did he shy away from legitimate uses of power. But rather, invoking the example of Lincoln in this book, he called for a middle path between absolute sovereignty and absolute liberty, and substitute absolute sovereignty for the unitary executive, and I think we come very close to some of Kirk's concerns. Within the country, again, he goes on, it says, it was to, in the 50s, to resist the communist threat, there were calls for the consolidation of American power. But he wrote, conservatives must stand firm against centralization, specious legislation that offers to substitute a passing security for prescriptive liberty, and the conversion of Republican government into plebiscitory democracy. He actually, not in this book, but in other places, called for a decentralized view of national defense without disclaiming the sole authority that the Constitution gives to the national government for defense, thought that as more protective of liberty, that states and localities should have a larger role. On the international use of power, he was just as clear. He wrote, a preventive war, whether or not it might be successful in the field, would be morally ruinous to us. Again, because it threatened liberty at home and also implied the creation of a unitary power and centralization rather than a free republic. The final question that I want to transmute into a challenge is only implied in the book in its closing chapter on re-enlivening the conservative mind, and that's the challenge of hope. Conservatives are good at being dour, even when times are good, and the challenges that I have identified out of Kirk's work, I think, are important ones and not ones to be taken lightly. But as he reminds us, cheerfulness will always break through. And given his Christian convictions about sin and redemption, he did not despair, even when the causes for which he fought and for which we fight seemed no closer to victory than when he started. I think that this cautiously optimistic view avoids the disillusionment of utopians of every stripe, left or right, when reality doesn't match their plans, as well as avoiding a postmodern despair of meaning, which cannot distinguish between decadence and progress. And I think that that perhaps is his most important challenge to us, and the challenge I think that needs to be overcome by those of us in this next generation. Thanks very much.